There is so much historical amnesia about what the empire really entailed. The fact that you don't really teach colonial history in your schools. Children doing A levels in history don't learn a line of colonial history. There's no real awareness of the atrocities, the fact that Britain financed its industrial revolution and its prosperity from the depredations of empire, the fact that Britain came to one of the richest countries in the world in the early 18th century and reduced it after 200 years of plunder to one of the poorest. But all of that is really not known anymore.
Indian writer, MP and scholar Shashi Tharoor, author of Inglorious Empire, What the British Did to India, heard here in conversation with a British journalist. In his book, Tharoor makes the case, as he famously did in a speech at the Oxford Union in 2015, that Britain owes reparations to its former colonies. But why, you may ask, when the British brought modernity to India? They introduced Indians to the pleasures of British bureaucracy, built with their own sweaty hands the railways that remain the main arteries of industry in India, and above all, introduced Indians to the best of British cuisine. India was but one of Britain's many colonies. A total of 65 countries have declared independence from Britain. Though the most prolific, Britain wasn't the only colonial power. Spain, Portugal, the Netherlands, and France make up the rest of the top five. Many of us, myself included, raised in former colonies with the colonial institutions still somewhat intact and school material rather dated, have grown up with history books that have many positive things to say about European empires. We learned and continue to learn history, how the colonial powers intended for us to understand it. And really, why would they lie to us? Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I am your host, Sean Macheza. Here at the State of Power podcast, we're interested in how power functions, how it mutates, and how it shapes the world around us. We believe that if we are to understand the present, we need to put it in its proper historical context and try to understand the historical processes that have led us here. This is the second episode in our three-part series in which we look at how Europe came to be dominant globally. In the first episode, we looked at racism and how it was used to justify European imperialism. And now, as the world seeks a decolonial future, it is good to remind ourselves of what colonialism really was. And in this episode, we take a closer look at how colonialism actually unfolded. I continue my conversation with Roger van Zwanenburg, who is the founder of Pluto Books, an independent publisher of radical left-wing nonfiction books. He's written a new global history called Wealth and Power, which he's sharing in a series of blogs, a link to which you can find in the podcast description. Roger's work traces the roller coaster story of the past 500 years or so of human history, focusing on how Europe and its offshoots amassed great wealth and power at the expense of the rest of the world. To deepen our understanding of colonialism, Roger began with looking at Russia and its vast territorial empire.
The first point I want to make, and it's a point I'll come back to, is that Russia was a feudal kingdom. And in the beginning of the 16th century, Russia was a small group of peoples around Moscow. Mm-hmm. And from there, it developed eastwards across Eastern Europe and across Siberia until 150 years later, in 1725, it reached the coasts of Asia. That was in 1725. So by over 150 years, it had conquered an area the size of a continent, and it has remained so to this day. Now, the important thing here is it was the only conquest which was on land, which didn't go across the seas. all the other European powers left Europe and conquered in the Americas, in Asia, and I'll come to that. But Russia was the one land-based imperial entity. Now, it was different and the same as the USA is, in a sense. But there is one major difference. The Russians didn't kill the indigenous people as they went across the land. They remained alive. It was still a colonial entity, but it was a feudal colonial entity. The people were left as they were, more or less. So Russia became an empire with a multitude of languages and ethnicities across its borders. And its purpose was to trade. They wanted in particular to control the fur trade. And they wanted to control the trade with China. But they were not involved in the same level of exploitation as occurred in the Americas. It was on simply a different level. And people today are, I'm still reading comparisons between the USA and Russia, both land-based empires, and yet nobody has picked up the fact that they were significantly different. Russia was an ancient empire. It was like the Ottoman Empire. They were after trade, controlling trade routes. They were not concerned to destroy the people they controlled. So there is really two, in my sense, there's ancient empires and there's the contemporary capitalist empires, which were the French, the British, the Dutch, and latterly all the others. And they are very distinguishable from the ancient empires like the Russian one. So the Russian Empire happened to coincide in terms of historical time with the empires coming out of Europe. And that's a point I want to really emphasize, because people don't really understand the enormous difference between these types of empires.
So would you say what's different between, say, the Russian Empire and the American Empire, as you put it, is the sort of plurality that was allowed, or the cosmopolitan nature of...
It was the cosmopolitan nature. They were not concerned to take over the land and settle the land themselves. Mm-hmm. They left the people with the agricultural systems that they had at that time. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's been very valuable to modern Russia because it's mineral rich. But at the time, they were not interested in these sorts of things.
Surely there were some negative effects for those people who were forcefully incorporated into the Russian Empire.
Well, of course, the people who incorporated into the empire had to pay taxes to the Russian monarchy. And in return, they were offered stability and would be looked after in terms of other people invading the place. So there were pluses and minuses. And some of the pluses were, of course, there were very few people, there were opportunities to go to Moscow and to learn new crafts. But on the whole, there were minuses. But the real important question is that it was an empire like the Ottoman Empire, like the empires of ancient times. It was an empire to enrich the center through trade, not through conquest of the land and the settlement of the land.
Mm-hmm. So it just happened that Russia, while it was expanding in this way as a sort of territorial empire, as a land empire that was sort of incorporating all its neighbors as it expanded, without necessarily taking them over. It just happened to rise up at the same time that you had this new other form of empire coming up, which is sort of the European version. So how do we compare these two? Can we look at the other side then?
The two happen to be side by side. The Russian court, which was a very wealthy court in Moscow, looked to France and spoke French very often. But it was an empire based on a monarchical system. So the center was based on feudal privilege, with the king or the queen being at the very center of all power. There were no serious changes until the late 19th century, when it was already becoming too late. The serfs were, some people have considered them as semi-slaves, but the serfs were at the behest of the local nobles. But it was a very different sort of empire than the ones coming out of Europe. The British were thought that the Russians wanted to invade India as well, and therefore they tried to stop that through controlling through the territory which we now call Afghanistan. And there were two wars there, both against the British. The Afghans lost in the 1840s, which was they lost a very large number of men. And then again in the 1860s and 70s, when eventually they did, in fact, agree to stop the Russians invading further south. There was also the fear that they would attack the Ottomans much, much further south, and that Istanbul, Constantinople, as it then was, would be attacked. And there's a whole history of Russian, Ottoman, British, and French interference in that area as well. So an ancient empire was always up against a modern, so-called modern empire, capitalist empire. And so the Russians would buy armaments from Britain and from France in particular to try and defend themselves.
So you already mentioned the two empires sort of, well, the British imagining that, or perhaps having information that the Russians wanted to expand into India, and India was a very prized possession of the British. I'd like us to get into that. But before we do, you mentioned that, so I'd like this to be sort of explicit, that you say the Russian Empire was relatively free of the ideology of racialism.
Very much so. There's many things you can say negatively or positively about the Russian Empire, but racism was not a part of that ideology in the same way as it was with the French and the Dutch and the British.
So let's now then look at India, which became in the end a point of contention.
Yes.
The British established, together with other European nations, this is after, I guess, India had been discovered, and they wanted to trade with India at the beginning. Did the relationship immediately start, as we pointed out in a previous episode where we spoke about the New World? Was India in the same category of spaces to be taken over as the New World was?
No. India was a different ballgame altogether, mm-hmm. in many respects. The initial impetus for the empires that arose in the period we're discussing, if you remember, I talked about the silk trade and how the Ottomans had taken the areas so they controlled the silk trade. So the Portuguese were first off in the middle 16th century, to and they sailed round the coast of Africa and then across the Indian Ocean and established themselves at Goa. Mm-hmm. So they were roughly 100 years ahead of the British or the French or the Dutch. Mm-hmm. The trade to India really got underway after the 1600s. And all the three major European nations established monopoly companies. These were the first instances of companies which were established by the monarch in each territory, in Britain, France, and Holland. And the rich paid for shares in these companies. There was the Dutch East India Company, the French East India Company, and the British. And then there was they established African companies, they established monopoly companies of all kinds. Mm-hmm. And these companies were...
So they're called monopoly companies because they aim to create a monopoly?
No, they did. There was nobody, only ships which were owned by each country's monopoly company could trade in that area.
Those territories, uh-huh.
And these...
So you couldn't just as a random, as just a regular Dutch person finance your own trip to India without being part of that monopoly company.
Okay. This is all part of the monarchies of each of these territories could earn money so that they could fight their internal wars. Because if you remember, I was arguing in the first time we talked about the internal religious wars, which were part and parcel of this period of time. So these things were happening simultaneously. The expansion into the world was happening at the same time as the Europeans were fighting amongst themselves and fighting over between the Protestants and the Catholics and in very, very unpleasant wars. So the monarchies needed money for these wars all the time. And part of the rationale of these monopoly companies was for that purpose.
It was fundraising essentially for war.
Yeah. But the other thing is that as these ships left port, they were not only trading companies, they were also organized for war. So they were warships which were supposed to trade. The distinction between the two was not as we have it today. They were both warships and trading ships at the same time. Mm-hmm. And for the first 150 years, really from 1600 to about 1750, they traded. And their problem was that the Indians and also the Chinese didn't want anything that was produced in Europe.
Uh-huh. So it was essentially, we are fine, we don't need anything you have.
Except gold.
Except gold.
Yeah, and if you remember, the gold that they...
This is how the New World factors in.
Came from the New World, exactly.
Uh-huh.
So they were carrying gold in order to pay for the silks and the textiles. The Indians were specially known for their very fine textiles. The Indians mm-hmm. and the Chinese actually didn't want anything that we produced. Mm-hmm. They considered their civilizations to be superior to anything that we had. Mm-hmm. So they were willing to sell us, the Chinese were willing to sell us porcelains and all the fine things that they produced. Yeah. The Indians were particularly good on fine textiles and fine cottons, which were unknown at the time in Europe. So that they were highly prized, and we took gold and silver. So that we could obtain this.
Uh-huh.
Now, this all changed in around 1767, mm-hmm. when Clive went to war and took over, and part of the agreement of the defeat of the Mughals was that he took over collecting taxes.
Uh-huh. So this is piggybacking on a system that's already in existence.
Already in existence. And from there onwards, for the next 100 years, from 1767 to about 1850, the British East India Company basically conquered about 500 different kingdoms, small kingdoms, throughout the Indian subcontinent.
Had these Indian princely states, as you call them, been coexisting peacefully and trading before the arrival of the British, or did the British sort of enter the fray and defeat everyone?
They were, on the whole, peaceful. Mm-hmm. There was, each kingdom had its own armed forces, mm-hmm. But they were all, they had their own specialities, and every part of India had many diverse specialities, and there was significant intercommunication and trade between them. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to get a handle on the standard of living of India at that time. But for the next 100 years, they gradually conquered the whole of the Indian subcontinent. And unlike the American continent, it was very much more developed, and it was a much larger population. And the opportunities that arose for the Dutch and for the British and for the French was that they could take over the running of each kingdom one by one. And it was at this time that the British and the Dutch came to an agreement that they would leave most parts of Asia to the Dutch, and mm-hmm. that they would control the Indian subcontinent.
So there was an actual agreement between the British and the Dutch to say, you go this way, we go that way, right. And we're not in each other.
With the French, it was different, because the period from the 1770s to 1815 was a period of huge disturbance in Europe, which of course included the French Revolution. It included the revolution in Haiti, and it included Napoleon and his conquest of Europe. So all this was going on at the same time. Uh-huh. And the French were defeated at that point. By 1815, the French were denuded of their colonial empire. Mm-hmm. So the French were very much weakened by that period, which left India to the British.
And so Britain now had sort of a free-for-all in India, and this was a time of fantastic fortunes for the British.
Because what they then did, they took control of trade, and they taxed the high quality goods, and they after 1815, as they started developing their own cotton industry, and manufacturing of cotton goods, they sold cheap goods to India, and they reorganized the whole of the Indian subcontinent so that they were unable to export their high quality goods, and they started buying the British. So in other words, what had happened, they turned India upside down. Instead of being self-sufficient, India now became dependent on the cotton trade with Britain.
Well, so India had initially been a net exporter of all these fine textiles.
Correct.
but within a short space of time had to import the textiles from the British industries.
Yes. Yeah.
And the British industries were making these textiles from cotton made in their colonies in the New World.
Correct.
So this is essentially Britain placing itself in the center and exploiting both ways.
Exactly. Exactly. You have it in one. Now, from the British point of view, it was an opportunity in all kinds of directions. First of all, Britain was a very small nation and had in India the armed forces from every from every small kingdom, which they then controlled. So India paid for the armed forces, which Britain then used to extend her empire across the world.
They invoiced the cost of the empire on the people who were conquered by the empire.
Exactly. Exactly. You have it. Extraordinary. Wow. And that is the basic reason that the British always thought of India as being the center of their empire.
So India was not only an imperial conquest, it was also sort of a springboard for more conquest.
That's right. The next area of conquest, of course, was China.
Yeah, let's get to that. And it's intricately linked with the British activities in India, right?
Now, what the Indian peasants had been growing opium for their own use for a very long time. The British decided to monopolize the sale of opium, and opium could only be sold through certain traders, and they monopolized the sale of opium and its production in huge factories. And then they packaged the opium and started selling it to the Chinese.
So the Chinese did not have an opium trade at this time.
No.
But the Chinese already consuming opium, and the British sort of took part in an already existing trade,
in a relatively very small way.
Yeah.
And the British expanded the opium trade enormously. Mm-hmm. The British controlled the opium trade to China. And the Chinese had allowed a small coterie of traders to be housed on the east coast of China. But they didn't allow them to mix with the Chinese more generally. And the Chinese emperor got very upset with this, and sent a senior person to start controlling the opium trade. And he intercepted the boats carrying the opium and sunk the opium in the water, in the seawater. The British...
So this is the Chinese... were trying to stop the British from bringing the opium, or was this a complete...
They tried to stop the trade altogether. They considered it a trade which should be abolished. The British responded by sending out ships from Britain all the way to China. This was just when they were beginning to use motorized shipping. They were still mainly sailing ships, but they sent battleships to China to teach the Chinese a lesson. And that is when they took Hong Kong in the 1840s. And from then onwards, they expanded, they defeated the Chinese initially, and they, as one did in those days, they asked to be paid in silver for the Chinese having defended themselves. And once that had happened, they then took a piece of land from which included Hong Kong and other parts, and said British laws will apply in this part of China, and we will trade as we wish from now onwards.
So the British presence on Hong Kong is directly linked to this opium conflict.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Very much so.
Yeah.
Once
these are the things that get lost sort of in the present when you see the upheavals in Hong Kong, and you see just recently, just a few days ago, China has said it will no longer recognize the British passport for Hong Kong. It sounds like removed history, but this is all tied back to those events.
Yes, all tied back to these events. That's absolutely correct. At the time, Hong Kong was hardly occupied at all, but it was therefore a very useful geographical position for the British to set up their trading posts and move into China proper.
What I find particularly compelling about this story is that the British Empire, the British Crown, or British companies at the time, went to war in order to keep the drug trade going. This is a specific policy of their large-scale drug traders. That's difficult to wrap my mind around. Because when you listen to contemporary rhetoric, you're like, well,
they were drug traders.
They were drug traders. Yeah,
they were drug traders, and there is a moving statement from the Chinese person who was put in charge of controlling the opium trade. He wrote a long letter to Queen Victoria, explaining why he thought decent human beings should not be trading in drugs. I have a copy of that letter. It's easy to find it on the net nowadays. And it shows, it illustrates the humanity of the Chinese leaders at that time. Mm-hmm. And it's expressed in terms of heaven and humans. Is an extraordinary piece of writing, but it essentially the British had moved their navy into China to support the drug trade, and that was the basis of it.
Yeah, this is the same British who were looking down at the Chinese from a racial perspective, and I guess also civilizationally. I think there must have been at this time already a sort of superiority complex from the British.
Exactly. The British refused to follow the customs of the time in front of the emperor, and had a very low view of the Chinese. It was only 2 decades later that they entered one of the old cities of China and burnt everything to the ground. They were so distasteful of things Chinese at that time.
Yeah,
Were
the British the only Europeans sort of entangled with the Chinese at the time? I'd imagine the French and the Dutch and others had interests in China as well.
Okay, that was what I was going on to say.
Yeah.
Thereafter, every old and new imperial power started in attacking China at different points along the coastline. The French and the Dutch, of course, but later in the 1880s, the Germans, the Americans, the Belgians, and by the end of the century, the Japanese. they'd all invaded. They all, each separately, company, each separate country invaded, succeeded in overcoming the Chinese, and demanded payment of in silver, because that was the currency the Chinese possessed. And they denuded the central government of the of currency. And they what happened was, the it was being at the time the emperor of China was run by one of the wives of the emperor, and throughout, in fact, much of the 19th century. And there's some splendid books about that. By 1900, China was on its knees. Its emperor had ceased to be in charge of China, and maps were being drawn. There's a map of China in 1900, which was published in the USA, breaking up China into its parts, rather as Africa was broken up into its parts in the 1880s. Mm-hmm. So they were all ready to dismantle China as a nation when the 1914-18 war broke out.
Yeah.
And that war probably saved China from being destroyed completely.
Uh-huh. So actually the breakout of the empires clashing in 1914 removed the attention from China and sort of brought back the attention to the war at home.
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
That's correct.
Yeah. So now I'm looking at time. And I'd like us to sort of wrap up. I'm thinking, you mentioned that India had such a vastly developed sort of rural industry. You had all these people with highly specialized skills. It wasn't just cloth, it was spices, it was all other things that the Indians were producing under these different princely states. And they had an industry so developed that when the Europeans first came, there was nothing really that they needed. And then you mentioned that the Chinese also had, I mean, the Silk Roads are famous even till the present for having been this conduit for this amazing pottery, porcelain, silk cloth, and all of this. But when the European empires were done, what you had was a totally destroyed China, a crumbling empire. You had India, which had been self-sufficient, now dependent on British industrial goods. What do you say then to the conversation, which I find surprising still happens in the present day? I just saw one very recently, where people say, well, but empire was good for these places. We brought modernity. We brought modern ways of doing things. We brought legal systems. And there's a whole litany of things that will be listed as having been beneficial to these colonized people.
Yeah, there's some well-established contemporary historians who still argue that the Western Europeans brought civilization. And by that, they mean they brought the rule of law, they brought railways, and so on.
And
so,
oftentimes private property, which
it's all based on private property. That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. And the essential argument of these historians is that we brought civilization to people who were less civilized than ourselves. It remains in my ears the arrogant, it's not nonsense, it's arrogant racism dressed up as modernity. Mm-hmm. And the one people I've I missed out in this discussion because it was a broad-ranging discussion with the Japanese. The Japanese saw what was happening in China, had a revolution of their own, overthrew the existing feudal monarchy, and immediately started sending their young people across the world to learn the secrets of industrialization. And within
this is around what time? When did Japanese do this?
This was the 1860s, the Meiji Rebellion. Mm-hmm. Within 40 years, they had turned their own society upside down. Mm-hmm. They had completely changed almost everything. They started education, widespread education. They learned the technologies from the West. They translated the books from Western sources, and they realized that their future, the Japanese had 450 years of peace. Mm-hmm. Now they decided that they were going to war, and they decided that they first of all took on Russia in, I think it was 1903 or 1901, and they defeated the Russians. And that was an illustration that they were on the way.
This announced their arrival, sort of.
A rival imperial power.
Yeah.
And they were the one and only country which, seeing the threat that the Western powers were to the rest of the world, were able to react positively and to copy the ways right the way down to being an imperial power themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So the Japanese story is a really very
self-driven, internally motivated
adoption
of this kind of societal theater.
But they were the only country in the world which was able to adapt and to alter its society sufficiently, mm-hmm, right the way across to be able to defend themselves against the marauding Western powers.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Roger. I really feel that what we're doing right now is very important work, because I know a lot of it sounds very basic to someone who's just read some world history or taken a history course, but the way history has been taught, I think, is very important. And I think it's necessary for us to revisit even the most basic historical facts, not rewrite history, but to write the actual real story of what happened. For me, there's nothing more frustrating than being someone from a former colonized country to hear someone say, well, but we brought education, we brought all of this, and I'm like, but well, what makes you think this is something we wanted? We had our own societies, we had our own ways of doing things, and they were working for us for millennia before the empire knocked on our doorstep. So I think it's good to look at not just empire from the imperial center, but also from the impact that it had on the colonized.
Well, I hope that's useful.
Most definitely.
We need to remember the past so that we don't repeat its mistakes. European colonial powers' belief in their entitlement to the world's resources led them to place little value on human life elsewhere. Their rapacious pillage has led humankind to the brink of a terrifying precipice. Imperialism placed the demands of the colonial powers ahead of any of the interests of the people and countries in the periphery, a hierarchy of lives according to a racial yardstick, with the white Europeans at the top and those with dark skin color at the bottom. Colonialism facilitated the needs of capital through the appropriation of natural resources, of mineral deposits, of culture, and of labor. That predatory logic and unbridled pillage was the wind fanning the colonial project, and part of the price
that was paid to create Western Europe as we know it today. Europe's prosperity is, more than anything else, the result of the colonial project and its ever-present legacy. It's a history that Europe is still only beginning to come to terms with, if at all. Thank you for listening this far. I have been your host, Sean Macheza, in conversation with publisher and historian Roger van Swanenburg. Roger's work is available for free, and a link to his blog is included in the podcast description. This episode is the second of three episodes based on Roger's work, Wealth and Power. The last one will be on the lessons of history for the contemporary world. If you're looking for another interesting podcast to listen to, check out the podcast Rebuilding Peace, Elendi Cuero Bravo, A Vision for Community, which tells the story of displaced Afro-Colombians in Llano Verde, who have been trying to piece back together their lives, especially after the community showed overwhelming support for Colombia's peace accords in 2016. But with government neglect leading to violent traumatic events like the August 2020 massacre of five Afro-Colombian boys, the community's hope for peace has been fractured. A link to this podcast is in the description. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni. If you have a moment, please do give us a review or a rating wherever you're listening to the podcast. This will allow us to reach more people and to improve our work. You can also find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.